Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm Avi Stamen, co-host of the Scholarly Communication podcast. When I'm not podcasting, I dedicate my time to my family, mountain biking, and running my company, Academic Language Experts. Academic Language Experts, or ALE, is an author services company dedicated to helping scholars elevate their manuscripts prior to publication, as well as grant proposals to receive research funding. You can find me at my name on LinkedIn, Avi Stamen, or on Twitter at ALE Translation. I'm glad and happy to be joined today by Jeffrey Harley-Mera. Jeffrey is a professor at the University of Puerto Rico in Magallanes and has a PhD from the Universidad Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona. He was the 2022 Obama Fellow at the Obama Institute for Transnational American Studies at Johannes Gutenberg University in Mainz. His book, Decolonizing American Spanish, Eurocentrism and Foreignness in the Imperial Ecosystem, was recently published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. Jeff, thanks so much for joining me today. It's nice to have you.
Yeah, it's great to be out here. Thank you so much for having me. And congratulations on this podcast. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you so much. And I appreciate also the early wake up in order to make this all possible. So maybe you could start us off by telling us just a little bit about this, the book that you published, Decolonizing American Spanish. And maybe what's interesting to me is not only what the book's about, but maybe the story kind of that led you up to deciding that this was an important book that you wanted to write.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Well, the book itself looks in on the ways that the U.S. university functions, in a sense, as a foreignizing apparatus for the Spanish language and as kind of a corollary to that, the people who use the Spanish language. And my own kind of personal kind of academic experiences, certainly at the University of Puerto Rico, have been very important in kind of my formation of these ideas. I did spend some time here when I was growing up. My grandparents lived in Aguadilla, but I didn't really live here until I was in my 30s. And when I did arrive here, and I discovered a lot of very interesting things with respect to the way that language, English and Spanish principally, but function in a university setting, and the things that the skills and the abilities and the experiences and the philosophies that are developed here at our university that are very unique. And I think that these capacities and these competencies are, for me, they're extraordinary in my own kind of personal academic experience. Especially in comparison to kind of my own experiences in the U.S. And so the book came about, it kind of grew out of two articles that I wrote, one called After Hispanic Studies, which appeared in Comparative American Studies, and then a commentary that appeared in the Lingua Franca section of the Chronicle of Higher Education. And the book was kind of a long time coming because those articles appeared in, I think, 2016, more or less. But then I got in touch with the people at Pittsburgh and they were interested in the book, but then Hurricane Maria happened and it was kind of like we lost like a year of basically academic life in Puerto Rico. But those are some, I think that my own kind of personal experiences and academic experiences, both as a student and as a faculty member, really kind of brought me into touch with the ways that language exists in Puerto Rico that are unique and that are, I would say, exceptional within the U.S. model.
Got it. And I'm curious if you can, aside from a general, kind of background, if there was a specific, can you remember a specific incident or a specific story whereby, you know, you were confronted with this issue, whether it be in a course or, you know, a comment that was made to you by a student or a faculty member that kind of got you thinking more seriously about this topic? Or was it more general kind of, being in that environment and experiencing it day in, day out?
Yeah, well, just some context about Puerto Rico and about kind of university and the way that Spanish and English kind of exist here. There are the Spanish language, it's a Spanish language institution. And so I would say, I mean, in my classes, when I first arrived, I would give the first introductory session in Spanish, just as a kind of out of interest, because that's the general language. And at the end of the class, at the end of that day, then the first session, I would give a poll to the students saying, if you'd like to have the class in Spanish or in English. And I stopped doing that eventually because there was never a class in the first maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 years that I did that activity that ever said that they were interested in having the class done in English. Nevertheless, I found that the linguistic capacities of the students in Spanish and in English is a resource for building knowledge. And the ways that faculty members and students are able to jump back and forth and examine different topics using language as a kind of a mode of exploration. And changing languages changes knowledge and it changes the experience of certain things. And so using that as kind of a lever to bring in new experiences of, and for example, studying a text that's in English, in Spanish, so reading a text in English, for example, I don't know, Hemingway or something, and talking about that in Spanish, those I found bring a lot of new depths into the conversation that I think are really not as accessible in an English, kind of English only and a Spanish only situation. So those experiences at the Universidad de Puerto Rico certainly kind of brought me into, and also what's another thing that I'd say kind of some personal experiences that I've noticed there, how when people come from the U.S. to our university, and this happens occasionally. A few months ago, the NSF had a program on our campus in December, and for whatever reason, I was invited, even though I'm a humanist. But I went, so I went, and I didn't really participate much because it's in the sciences, and I'm really work in literature and in art and philosophy. But it was interesting to see how the people who were involved in it from the Universidad de Puerto Rico, the faculty members, how the language change happened. So when before the people from the U.S. arrived in the room, we were speaking in Spanish, having a regular conversation. And then as soon as the people from the U.S. people came in, the language changed. And this, it makes me think of, I don't know if you're familiar with Thurston Veblen's work, but he has a concept, skeptical animus, which brings in what he calls in German, the Unbefangenheit, which is a kind of an impartiality. And I thought, I felt like that was something that was very tangible in that room once the language change occurred. And I thought it was very, that those types of experiences are unique because there are multiple things happening. But if you're coming from the English language mindset, the monolingual mindset, only one type of thing is happening and the other thing is kind of marginalized. So anyway, just those are just some other reflections about that day. There was, I didn't, like I said, I didn't really say much during those because I'm in the humanities, but at the end of the sessions, one of the people said, is there anything that you guys have, suggestions that you guys have? And, I raised my hand and I said, well, you should really, since we have science classes here in Spanish and a lot of research that's done in Spanish, you guys should receive applications and conduct peer review in Spanish. And everyone on the panel really agreed with that. And it wasn't something that seemed to be, and in that sense, I know that our institution is a model for others in that we already do all of these things in two languages and the ways that knowledge itself can be grown in certain ways that can't occur really, even in the sciences, in a monolingual environment.
So let's talk about America for a second, and I'm curious to ask you about kind of, in America, I think, even if Spanish may be a recognized language, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find too many colleges where you're going to be hearing Spanish in the classroom, at least from a professor. So, and in other places in the world, it's a lot more common to have, bilingual or even many languages being spoken across courses, whereas I think in the U.S. it seems like it's, maybe, I don't know what the official numbers are, but I'd guess in the high 90s in terms of the number of classes beginning in English. So I'm curious, kind of maybe you can give us a little bit of a history of why that is, how that came about, and what you think some of the, what are some of the downsides? What are some of the risks that we're taking as a result, or some of the collateral damage, but consequences that we pay as a result of that approach?
Yeah, well, there is a rich history of course, of many different languages in the U.S. And it's kind of the institutional plow of kind of English only that attempts to, and that's something that's relatively new. And there were, in the early part of the 20th century, there were hundreds of non-English language periodicals around the U.S. And that seemed to start to constrict institutionally around the First World War. Teddy Roosevelt was a kind of a famous monolinguist, and there was also kind of a period of time in which even studies in linguistics considered use of multiple languages as a shortcoming. And that has changed, and there are some circumstances with, for example, children who grew up with multiple languages have not significantly, but there is a measurably difference in kind of the size of the vocabularies available in both languages. And so on. Nevertheless, so those things were happening both in the academy and out of the academy. And there were political and social and kind of cultural things that were occurring, especially with the circumstances with people arriving to the U.S. and the pressure to kind of quote-unquote Americanize themselves. And in doing that, to abandon other languages other than English. But there are, I think, many, many shortcomings to kind of using English as a lingua franca. You know, the homogenization of in a language sense is, it privileges people and it silences others. It gives some people opportunities. But I think we all are poorer for this, because not only for those social justice, but also cultural, but also the knowledge itself is restricted. And there are many studies that people who use more than one language on a daily basis have different capacities than others with respect to depth of attention and creativity and many positive things that are developed. And those are things that I don't know that are experienceable within a monolingual kind of English only environment.
Yeah. So I'm curious, you mentioned about publications and periodicals, and I'm curious because that's where this topic really kind of hits me the most, which is, we've consciously or just by inertia adopted English as the lingua franca of academic publication. And I think, you've made a strong counter argument for what we're kind of losing as a result of that and what voices it may be, not expressing properly. And I guess the counter argument or to play devil's advocate would be to say that, well, if you've got, if everyone can publish in their own language, do you actually have a common science terminology that can be used in order to describe a phenomenon, in order to come to a consensus, in order to create a dialogue, right? So is there a risk on the other side of using different, if we're speaking in different languages, not being able to really have a constructive conversation that moves us forward, and therefore maybe forcing everyone to write in English, even if people have different starting points, is the price that we need to pay in order to enable that coherent dialogue? What would you say to that approach?
I think that there are arguments to be made. There are arguments to be made, but forcing people to use a language that's not of their choice, or even a language that's not of their daily kind of surroundings, there are kind of the way that kind of lops off opportunities. And I mean the price is enormous for across many different. I mean, when you look at literacy, driving literacy itself through English and away from Spanish, in ways that these put people out of universities. But when you look at, for example, certain attrition rates and graduation rates are very very much affected by that. And there are certain communities that are. And so, if these communities, for example, were to have access to institutions like universities, but also certainly middle schools and high schools and so on, within their own context, within their own, if the language of the institution were kind of reciprocal with what was happening in the community, these would grow knowledge, and I don't have any real question about that. In ways that, in much beyond kind of the social justice angle, when you think about when you think about what types of solidarity are being voiced, this kind of the ways that English is privileged. These affect many different things. And yeah, I mean, there's a phrase, in fact, from one of my students, Ingrid Millán, tiene que ver con quién controla a quién. So the language involved has to do with who controls whom. And even though we're talking about ostensibly these ideas of knowledge being something that is alinguistic, I think it's a very charged idea to say that knowledge is neutral and alinguistic and texts can be translated, you know, as the de facto kind of natural language of academic life. English being the language of science and the humanities, it must be at the center of what our educational systems do. Those are very difficult, really, to sustain those when you look at them, what is actually happening, and the possibilities and the restrictions that are embedded in that.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's interesting because it's, you know, I find that sometimes researchers, not only do they publish or, you know, kind of like feel the impetus to publish in English, but oftentimes they will publish it in English against their own better judgment. Meaning what I mean by that is I remember a particular story where we had a scholar who was studying poverty in South America came and wanted us to translate her article into English. And I asked her why, you know, like that's, you know, kind of what was the goal? And she's like, well, I need to get it published and I, you know, in English. And I said, well, who's the audience? And she said, well, you know, policymakers in South America. And I said, well, then why do you want it in English? She said, well, for career tenure, and then I can worry about the impact later. And that wasn't something she was saying proudly. She was actually quite bothered by that. But I said, well, what is the point of doing all this research if it's not going to actually get to the decision makers who can do something about it? And I think, you know, so I definitely agree with you. And I think that one of my optimisms and hopes is that, you know, as technology progresses, we might, you know, potentially could at a cheaper cost than we're currently doing, be able to render a text in parallel in many languages and really open it up, first and foremost, to the local population that the research is really impacting or the study or the participants were members of, but even more generally to, you know, to lay folks who may not be able to really, you know, take it in. And even, to be honest, even researchers, right? I think that's kind of one of the big bluffs in academia is that everyone pretends like they, you know, are comfortable and familiar with English. And it's really a spectrum, right? Some people really are near native, but as someone who's been living in a foreign country for about 17 years, I can tell you that, you know, there is there's a difference. No matter how long and no matter how proficient you become in another language, it's never your mother tongue, right? I always say you can only have one mother, so you can only have one mother tongue. That's a debatable point. But I think, you know, just in terms of level of comfortability engaging in the topic, that's, you know, it's kind of an important thing for all of us to think about.
And with respect to something that often leads to academic publications, this would be for us, you know, external funding, grant proposals and so on. Those are, in fact, just some reflections about how those English only competitions affect our campus, and they kind of sort out, you know, people and so on. My colleagues and I have had some very interesting kind of conversations in recent years about how this impacts people, in that, you know, if you want to, even in the humanities, even the American Council of Learned Societies and the National Endowment for the Humanities, these are English only institutions. And we had a roundtable a few months ago with Margarita Benitez, who's the former director of the Fundación Puerto Rican y las Humanidades, the Puerto Rican Humanities Council, Ignacio Sánchez Prado, who's a professor at Washington University in St. Louis, Joy Connolly, who's the president of the American Council of Learned Societies, and Juliana Kudler, who's an officer at NEH, and the title was about English-only competitions and reconsidering the impact of rejection. And in this, coming into this conversation as a humanist, speaking to and with humanists about language, about the role of language in, you know, in external funding situations. And we are in a situation in Puerto Rico that is, I don't know that it's unique. Well, it is probably is unique that since Hurricane Maria, our institution has had a 40% budget reduction. So we are in, things here are, and the humanities, of course, are affected much more severely than other people on the campus. So in order to do the most basic activity in our professions, it's effectively put on us to secure external funds to do this. And so I had a period of time when I was working as an administrator, as a senator at the university, and then as the department chair, department director, And so we took this on, and I encouraged my colleagues and so on to look into to applying for external funds, and we did. So we applied for NEH, we applied for ACLS money, and all of these grant proposals were rejected. And at doing the assessment of those, there were hundreds of hours lost. There were hundreds of hours lost to those. And we are not in a position in which we can lose hundreds of hours. And thinking about the extra work that is involved for people who are in our positions working in Spanish about texts that are in Spanish, why is it this necessity that we have to study, victory, Puerto Rican culture, but post-Maria Puerto Rican in English? What is the purpose of this? Why is this exigency there? Who benefits from it? Who is impacted by it? How does it destroy, what we're trying to do here? And it does, it is destructive. And in fact, in the and in this conversation that we had, which was first kind of over email, but then over MSN Teams, it was pretty, I don't want to say it was insulting or offensive, but it was very disappointing. What Jeff Burrows, who's from NEH, wrote to me, saying that, the federal law requires that that applications, but he sent me the federal regulation, and I can't remember right now if the word was application or submission, was for application. I think it was application for funds have to be in English. And so, okay, we're in the humanities. What is your responsibility in this when this federal regulation is destructive to human lives? In the same way that federal regulations in the past have certainly not recognized people's citizenship, people's humanity. And now in this case, we have a language issue that does something that's very similar, that destroys people's opportunities and so on. What is your responsibility in doing this? And I myself put forth some suggestions. We can really look closely at what these words say, what these words mean, and identify them. And so if application, the word in itself, the key word there, submit the application in Spanish. If we look into this institutional definition of application, it means a formal solicitation of funds. So put the formal solicitation of funds in English, one sentence, and then write the narrative in Spanish or something like that. I mean, there are lots of kind of solutions to this. And what the response from them was, well, you're going to have it rejected. And, okay. I mean, and in a symbolic sense, in a solidarity sense, yes, let's write this, get it rejected, so we can say, look, this was rejected because of this linguistic discrimination that you are carrying out, this linguicide that you are institutionally wielding and carrying out. And I don't know. I don't think that it's defensible, really, in any, especially in the humanities. And the ACLS responses too were similarly kind of disappointing in that saying that. And one of the arguments that they had was that we just don't have people who can do peer review in Spanish. And I said to myself, what planet are you living on that you can't find? It just like we are in our faculty, there are 350 faculty members in the arts and sciences. 300 and probably 35 of them could do peer review in Spanish. And we're one of 11 campuses at the Universidad de Puerto Rico. I mean, but at any rate, those institutions swimming in resources and money and all of the power, the social and cultural power that they have, but also financial, and saying that they don't have the resources for this, I find it just hard to, I don't know. I feel like there's a real disconnect between what we are living and what they are doing and how their policies are not beneficial. And I understand that. I'll finish it real quickly. It's a long response, but I understand those institutions, the National Agreements and the American Council of Societies. I understand that they have some reciprocal responsibility to the communities that they ostensibly serve. And I think this is an important one, a central one in the humanities, to recognize language as a mechanism of creation and of knowledge.
Right. So it's really interesting points you're making. I'm curious, to hear from you kind of what, we kind of saw that you presented, I think, in a compelling way, the downsides or the risks, and the maybe, lack of openness. I'm wondering if we can make, if you can make an argument on the flip side for what the potential benefits and gains are. If we could incorporate not only translation, but also, maybe even thinking primarily or thinking from the very outset of other languages that this would get consumed in. I mean, it could be anything in my mind from, the website of the institution to the handbook for the students to publication. So what potential latent potential does translation or does multilingualism have in store that maybe we're not taking advantage of?
Yes, I agree. Certainly all those things, the websites being available, for example, the forms that you have to fill out and all this kind of rigmarole or the kind of institutional steps before you even submit anything, you know, there's really an avenue there to help a lot of people, to connect, to include a lot of people by taking on these types of action. Translation, I think maybe in the sciences it might be a little bit different, but in the humanities, I find it as a very kind of a charged topic. I think about when I lived in Barcelona, there wasn't a linguistics program, or there was actually, but I was in the kind of the cultural studies, but I ended up having friendships with people who were linguistic graduate students, and as like a second job, they were translators for into Spanish from certain movies and video games, and they would always like search me out to say like, what does this mean in Spanish, and so on. And I remember one of the instances where it was a Lord of the Rings movie, and the phrase in English was, "We will travel light," you know, and that's when they were about to, you know, get on their horses and go wherever, and they had translated this "Viajaremos de día," which means "We will travel by day," and I remember saying to the guy who was translating, I said, "This doesn't exactly mean that. I know that like in a literal sense, it does seem like that because the words light, you know, it indicates day, it would indicate daytime, but this is another kind of an idiomatic phrase, and travel light means to travel without carrying a lot of things." And he said, no, but he went with that translation that he had. And I remember when I went and saw it in the movie, and all the movies there have the subtitles in Spanish, and they put Viajaremos de día, and I remember saying to myself, God, you know, and that's a very small thing. That's a very small thing, but those things are happening. All those can be knowledge. I mean, very small words can have enormous meanings, enormous significance. And that one maybe doesn't, but other things do. And I don't know, when I think about, and I don't know if you've ever had your texts translated into languages, into your other languages, for example. When I have had my work translated into Catalan and into Spanish, and translated into Spanish happens pretty often, but it's always like, I would never say this that way. It's kind of like, I can speak Catalan, but my Spanish is certainly my dominant language. And so when I see it, I can read and into what this person is misunderstanding in this translation. And the words could mean the same thing, and they kind of do. It's kind of like I have two sisters, and like if they were to recount a story that happened to me to other people, that they're going to say it in a certain way. That's kind of like, yeah, I guess that's sort of right. But you know what? I mean, I'm sure that I do this would do the same thing when I'm talking about my sisters about, you know, whatever happens to them. But it's kind of a disconnect. These things create changes that kind of differentiate authorial. You know, in the humanities, I think that's they're very much more complicated than in the sciences. I would like to think more about the use of, I think you said machine translations and using those as tools. I think that those can be used as tools, and they should be used as tools. I think we should always have a real kind of critical mind about whatever tools that we are using and thinking about the context that they come from and where they, what the outcomes are and how they are often, and if not always, erred.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, you know, what are some of your proposals or suggestions that you've put forward? I mean, you mentioned to us about the grant proposals, but, you know, whether it's in the academic environment and ecosystem in general or in publishing in specific, what would be some of your suggestions or ideas to, you know, make academia a little bit less monolingual and open up opportunities for publishing in other languages?
Yeah, well, I think that the Universidad de Puerto Rico and Puerto Rico in general have already kind of figured many of these things out. In that, even though what is happening here is, you know, it's a colonial destruction, I would say a programmatic destruction of culture and language and so on, it's what's very interesting about, especially the Universidad de Puerto Rico, is the way that these things come and the way that they are dealt with internally in a specific way that, and language is a very fundamental part of that. And when you examine kind of this, and I think that Thurston Belbin's term for this is very useful, this impartiality toward, and I would describe it as impartiality toward kind of the imperial narratives in the Prader myths, in this case, the English language. Maybe you have to use it because it's forced onto you, and those things happen in life, and they're terrible, and they shouldn't happen, and we should do everything we can so that they do not. But that when they do, how do you interact with this? How do you move with it? How do you make it? How do you benefit? How do you not benefit from it? How do you make it your own, and so on? And I would say that because the notion of kind of the Americanization of Puerto Rico has largely failed. And it's, yes, you're going to drive down the street and see, you know, the chain stores and so on, but you're not going to hear the English language, and you're not going to, you know, I think it's very difficult to imagine, you know, kind of the, but the Puerto Ricanization of the U.S. And the example that I use in the book is really thinking about how the competencies that are developed at our university would be very implementable, maybe not implementable because in certain areas, but with respect to Spanish, because you know, Spanish is not a significantly minority language at everywhere, but it is many, many, many places. But thinking about this kind of Puerto Ricanization of the U.S. higher ed, and that, you know, if saying, for example, a phrase or a sentence or a paragraph or even an entire class or even an entire course in Spanish is not an incendiary thing, but it's an ordinary thing because it's something that is interacting with. And that's what the decolonial move really does, is it unlinks from these imperial narratives, and it localizes knowledge production. And so having the language of each institution be reciprocal, not to the imperial narrative, not to English, but rather to what is the local language. And I'd like to just say some cases that I'd like to note. And I grew up in Massachusetts, and the languages where I grew up certainly were, there was English, but there was also Portuguese. Up until I was 8 years old, I lived in a part of Falmouth, Massachusetts called T-Ticket, which kind of right abuts a part of town called East Falmouth. And East Falmouth is kind of like, the seat of Portuguese culture in that area. And when I was going on the bus and things, and when you hear Portuguese and then, especially in the soccer field too. But then by the time you get to high school, the only time that you hear it was on the soccer field. You would go up to these kids who are, you know, a friend of mine, for example, John Raposa, whose parents are from Portugal. He was born in the U.S. You would go up to him and ask him, like, John, do you speak Portuguese? He'll look you right in the eye and say, no. And I'm thinking to myself, and you think to yourself, you know, John, 2 days ago I was at your house and, you know, the phone rang, you picked it up, you spoke to your grandmother in Portuguese and then hung it up. And then, you know, but this is the way that Portuguese language there in that place is stigmatized and is made something like a black mark in that reality is terrible. Now, I'd like to just say, though there are resistance to that. You know, there's a UMass Dartmouth, which is a university right across Buzzards Bay from us, right next to New Bedford. New Bedford is really, I don't know if you're familiar with Massachusetts, but New Bedford is really kind of like the one of the hubs of Portuguese American culture in Massachusetts, certainly, if not the whole country. But in fact, John Raposa's, this friend of mine's parents moved there, and I think his mother finished high school there, and then they moved to Falmouth. But there, so in the university there, which is UMass Dartmouth, they have a Portuguese language and cultural program, which that type of thing should be happening everywhere, especially in Massachusetts. And you know, when I think about one of the places where I like to go most with my parents in Massachusetts, even though we don't speak Portuguese at home, I wish we did, it's called Mary Ellen's Diner, where the Portuguese is the language in that diner where we go. And this institutionalizing that language, what it would do for people like John Raposa, people like Alvaro Melo, people like Luke Silva, people like, you know, the friends of mine that I kind of grew up with. And it would mean new things for them, but also for me, you know, and for everyone there. And these things are happening on a smaller scale, like on a local scale. Like I said, I'd like to say that, to cite that at UMass Dartmouth and in Macedo, there's a man who's at UMass Boston. He retired, but he's from Cabo Verde. And he's worked a lot on this and this. So these things are happening. Because the way that kind of, you know, I'd say Massachusetts, that's where I've experienced, but the power and the imperial power of these institutions is so great that you're always kind of pushing against the tide. Amariles Melo, also, he's another person who's important in this dialogue with respect to language in Massachusetts. But I think, so those are spaces that are being built. And now that we are kind of in a decolonial kind of period that is kind of questioning these imperial narratives and the positive notion of a myth of kind of English in all these spaces. And those are just being able to ask that question, you know, is the presence of English in this space, is this a positive, or not, or in this classroom, what is it doing? How is it affecting people's culture and people's identity? And how is the institution, what could it be doing better? Yeah. And I think that Puerto Rico is an excellent, excellent example for that. And I think that U.S. Dartmouth is too. I want to say both of those. But because of, you know, English is here in the Universidad de Puerto Rico, está aquí. But it is certainly dealt with in a way that I feel is very, very unique, and it's very interesting, because it's you can kind of play with it and use it in a way for your own it and to in your own way.
Amazing. Fantastic. Jeffrey, this has been really, really interesting and insightful, and I appreciate you taking the time to come on with me today and to speak. If folks want to like see your research, your primary research, or maybe, you know, follow you or learn more about you online, what's the best way to go about doing so?
Well, you can reach out to me. I send a lot of email. We don't have here. We don't have Project Muse. So I often, like every week, I spend a lot of time sending email to scholars to get their research, because I said put mine up on sometimes on academia.edu and LinkedIn. But, you know, I'm available online, certainly. I think we had a lot of excellent kind of connections that way, certainly.
Great. Brilliant. Fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. This has been really interesting, especially, you know, coming from the world of author services, where we often help primarily English as an additional language scholars. That's my day-to-day, to hear someone kind of take it and talk about the theory, but also practice, and really resonates with me a lot. And I think that it's important. You know, there are a lot of issues for us, for society to take care of, but I think language sometimes, for some reason, takes a backseat oftentimes. So I appreciate your work to kind of bring it to the fore and remind people that it's something that's really important. And I look forward to continuing our conversations and seeing kind of what progress you make. I think, you know, it sounds like, you know, you've made some impressive, you know, steps until now, but there's a lot more work to do.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I agree. And then this kind of lethargy towards language, I think, is starting to erode a little bit. And it's in part to work like yours. Also, the fact that the New Books Network has that in Spanish. Genial. Oye, enhorabuena. So thank you.
There you go. Shout out to Marshall there for making sure. Yes, I spoke to him. I know that's an important priority of theirs, is to make sure that New Books Network is not is multilingual and is not monolithic monolingual anymore. So that's it's baby steps, but it's steps in the right direction.
Absolutely. And I mean, the New Books Network is, you know, it's not as good as coffee, but in the morning it is fabulous. It's been a wonderful part of my day, especially yours. I really enjoy yours, of course.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey. I appreciate the compliments. So have a great rest of your week. And we look forward to following up on this chat in the next few months.
Take care. Thank you.